This is Views from the Watershed. I'm Lizzie Mogul, your tour guide. We are at the Ashokan Quarry Trail. Here, 120 years ago, stone was cut out of the ground, put onto rail cars, and moved 3 miles north where it was used to build the Ashokan Reservoir. It's very quiet here. The only sounds are birds, the wind in the trees, and a few hikers. But back in the day, it was dusty, noisy, and hazardous, full of the sounds of men and machinery. Previously in this podcast tour, you've heard about the water, policy, and social infrastructures that make the New York City water system in the Catskills what it is today. Now you'll hear about the labor infrastructure that made it all possible, and about the thousands of people who built the system over 60 years. We'll hear again from my favorite Catskills historian, Diane Galusha. We'll also hear the voice of Dan Underwood, who worked on reservoir construction and whom Diane interviewed in 2023.
The workers are sort of the invisible part of this massive infrastructure project. Human people like you and me actually built these amazing structures. And they are really the invisible piece of this amazing system. I've often marveled at their skill and fortitude and what they put up with to work in really difficult circumstances. Didn't get paid much, just needed to work to support families or send money back home or whatever they did with it. It's a personal story as much as it is a public work story.
The first part of the system to be constructed was the Ashokan Reservoir and the Catskills Aqueduct. This difficult, dangerous work began at a time when we didn't have the machines and the technology that we do now.
The Catskill Aqueduct was truly a feat of engineering and, of course, construction to get the water 8 miles in from the Hudson to New York City, 120 miles or something, to the south, with a river in between, and also to navigate this rocky, hilly terrain, cross underneath streams, pierce mountains, and then go underneath the Hudson River, 1,100 feet under the Hudson River. You know, it's one thing to put it on paper, and then you got to have people build them. You have to have people who are tough and can endure terrible weather. They worked all year long. It was a really difficult thing to do. They weren't just building reservoirs and tunnels, you know. There was a lot of stuff that had to happen before they could even begin to do that. Carpentry shops, blacksmith shops, storehouses, the work roads, bridges, and the grubbing was a huge part of it. Grubbing is removing all traces of humanity from the basin floor. And there was a lot of manual labor that was required that would later be done by heavy machinery. Men and horses and mules did much of the work, four-wheeled wagons and such. There were power plants for air compressors and steam generation to run drills and engines. There were steam shovels. There were cableways that brought cement and sand and stone from different directions. There were quarries. There were stone crushers. There were mixing plants. Those quarries are actually still able to be seen. You can hike to some of them and ponder the life of somebody who had found himself maybe 2 months ago was living in Italy and today is sitting in a quarry in the Catskills, making a buck a day to build something that would outlast him and all of us for centuries.
Diane, tell me about the workers who built the system.
The vast majority of the people, maybe 80-85% of workers on the Ashokan were immigrants, and most of those were from Italy. But there were many languages spoken in those camps, Hungarian, Russian, Slavic languages. Many of the people who worked there migrated from Pennsylvania, where they worked in the coal mines. So they had mining experience and were sought to work in those tunnels. The workforce for the Ashokan Reservoir did include a large contingent of African-American workers from the South. They didn't live with the rest of the workers. They were segregated. That's, you know, another invisible subset of people who produced this engineering feat and construction feat.
During the construction of the Ashokan, workers lived in camps that were built to house them. What were they like?
The camps were really like little cities. The main camps had streets and street lights, multiple schools for children of those immigrant families, recreation hall where they could read newspapers in their own language. Staffers from various social agencies would come and provide entertainment or provide assistance or education, teaching people English. There were sewage systems. There was a pretty elaborate food production system, 5,000 loaves a day of bread that they made. They had to feed all these people in addition to house them. But you know what? It cost them. They spent 65% of their earnings for room and board. You know, it wasn't free, but it wasn't a terrible way to live when you think about how immigrants were crammed into tenements in New York City and were struggling to make a living there. This seemed more humane, actually. The main camp, for instance, in the Ashokan Reservoir was built in a semicircle below the dam site. And it included barracks and dormitory housing for single men, cottages or small houses for families. The Italian workers, they loved to cook. And this was somewhat unlike the single white men in the barracks buildings that just wanted to go sit down in the cafeteria and eat. But in the Italian enclave, you could smell garlic and you could see homemade pasta hanging on racks and drying.
Were people paid well for their work?
Back in the early reservoir projects, the pay scale was pretty minimal. It was like $1 a day, $1.20 a day, and for a common laborer, a little bit more if you handled explosives or were an electrician or something. So a lot of local folks shied away from those jobs because they could get the same amount of money working on dad's farm or somebody else's farm. Periodically, the workers would strike or try to get more money. In the Delaware projects, you were making $1.50 an hour. That actually was considered decent money. They took those jobs rather than stay on the farm. They would rather have a job that you could work 8 hours a day instead of working 16 hours a day on the farm.
Dan Underwood worked on the Delaware system, and he talked to you about his pay.
At the time, it was big money. I was a miner. When I got to be a miner, I was the second high-paid man in the tunnel. The only guys made more were electricians, and I got $2.25 an hour, plus overtime. We'd have 2 weeks on the day shift, 2 weeks on the swing shift, and 2 weeks on the graveyard shift. My graveyard shift was a tough shift.
Diane, in your book, Liquid Assets, about the history of the water system, you detail the injuries and deaths that happened over the course of this 60-year project, the number of which was especially high during the construction of the Catskill system.
It was a very dangerous environment to work in. Narrow gauge railroads were everywhere on these sites, both on the surface and in the tunnels. Many people were crushed between cars or run over. There were obviously falling rocks in the tunnels and at excavation sites around the reservoir basin. There were mules and horses, and you could get hit by a runaway wagon or fall off a scaffolding, fall off the top of the dam, a lot of dynamite in the tunnels, and just blasting rock in the quarries. There were other things that were unforeseen, like swarms of bees and floods and snowstorms. There were a lot of communicable diseases in that day and age. If you got hurt and your wound was infected, there weren't antibiotics that you could just take care of that. That was a potential killer. And there were any number of ways to get hurt and to get killed, and many people did. You know, there weren't safety harnesses and hard hats. You were on your own. You live or you don't.
A lot changed between the construction of the Catskill system and the Delaware system. The work was still hazardous, but there was a lot more government regulation on safety and worker protections.
You had to be a dues-paying union member to get the job.
Dan Underwood was a union member, and he helped to build the Delaware Aqueduct.
Worked on the tunnel. I just one of many. You know, there's a whole bunch of us. It was just a small cog on the wheel, so to speak. You know? When you get in the tunnel, it was, of course, it was dark and damp, 52 degrees year-round. We had water. We had quite a few things. Gas. We had to shut down for gas once. And we had methane. It could come bubbling up through the floor. It was great. It was, you know, explode. And then water, we hit water. That was something. Boy, the water came gushing right in. We scampered to get out of there. And then we had to drill holes. And we brought concrete pumps in, quick drying stuff. We pumped for, it was a week. Finally, we stopped the water. It stopped a lot of other water, too. Created a lot of problems because some of the farmers around, they shut their wells right down. It was quite a problem over that.
The Ashokan was finished in the teens and the Schoharie in the mid-20s. And the Rondout and Neversink were finished around 1950 or so. In the intervening years, technology changed and construction processes changed with the advent of diesel engines and other advances that allowed the work to go on day and night. The Delaware system found workers with hearing loss because there was a lot more equipment that made a lot of noise. I mean, it was just a really, really noisy place, and it was 24 hours a day. And there was also the terror that some men felt going to work for the first time in those tunnels and getting in the elevator with a bunch of other men and descending 600 feet. It's dark. It's cold. It's wet. It's claustrophobic. And a lot of people didn't last very long down there. They got right back in the elevator and they went right back up to the surface because they couldn't handle it. You had to have a certain steely resolve to lower yourself into the center of the earth and chip away at ancient rock towards some eventual goal of sending water to millions of people that you will never know and they will never know you.
Diane, how did the living conditions change in the time between the construction of the Catskill system and the Delaware system?
In those early projects, because of the transportation situation, they lived on site until it was done. But in those Delaware projects, people were much more mobile. A whole subset of workers who were kind of professional public works employees would travel around the country looking for these big jobs and became this mobile workforce. And about this time in the 50s or so, the mobile home became a possibility. You could just pull your house wherever you needed it to go and park there for the next 4 years while you worked there and then move on to the next job. So there was this cohort of public works construction workers who brought their families and their kids enrolled in the local schools for the duration. And they had their own kind of community. There was also local folks who worked there and in many cases worked on projects that were actually displacing their families, which I always found very poignant. But when you needed a job, you needed a job.
This influx of workers must have had an impact on the towns around the reservoirs.
The towns between reservoirs were boom towns during these construction periods. Margaretville and Downsville on both ends of the Papacton Reservoir benefited pretty substantially during the construction. The influx of children meant that both schools in Downsville and in Margaretville were expanded. Downsville went from like 200 kids to 600 kids. And the same was true in Margaretville. Now, obviously, there's not 600 kids in Downsville anymore, and there's not 600 kids in Margaretville anymore. So that impact went away. Workers left when the reservoir was completed. A number of people who worked on the dams and in the tunnels were smitten with the area. Some stayed. I've talked to several people who had their early encounter with the Catskills was when they came here to work on the reservoirs and then came back because they remembered how beautiful it was. I think there is a sense of real pride among people who worked on these projects. They point to what stands there now and will for eternity and say, I did that. I helped with that. They told their kids that, and their kids told their kids that. And even though they weren't necessarily recognized for it at the time, there was no real public recognition, they did their part, and they're proud of it, and rightly so. It's a lasting point of pride in many families who may have conflicting emotions about what it cost, the communities that were lost. But still, there's no denying the accomplishment.
It's part of my life. I'll always remember. I mean, it was really something.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Views from the Watershed. Learn more about this program at walkingthewatershed.com/podcasttour.